Thank you. The doctor will take questions, and please ask questions and not give lectures.
Is the commission to implement Proposition 13 working on the labor managers getting together or protecting their flags and all that?
Well, that's a good question, and I wish I could answer it with assurance. The commission, may I say, has a much broader mission than exploring the effects of Proposition 13. It's entitled the Commission on Government Reform, and consists of 12 ladies and gentlemen from various walks of public life in California. For instance, we have the principal executive of the AFL-CIO, the head of the California Farm Bureau, a judge who is a spokesman for the Chicano community, a newspaper publisher, some businessmen. I think I'm the only academician on the commission, and I guess I was put on there as a penalty for having taken a role in the enactment of Proposition 13. The commission, you might be interested, has organized itself into four committees. There's a committee on the post-Proposition 13 effects, what adjustments or changes, amendments to the law may be necessary. That is headed by Mayor Bradley of the city of Los Angeles. There's a committee on the reorganization of government. California now has some 6,000 different taxing units, and it's believed there are opportunities for conserving public funds by consolidation and reorganizing government. That is headed by Mr. Wilson Riles, who's the superintendent of public instruction. There's a commission on the expenditure structure of the state, which is headed by Mr. Casper Weinberger, who was formerly head of the health, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare in the federal government. And there's a commission on taxation and revenue, which is seeking to recast the revenue system of the state in a way that will be more equitable and will foster the development of the welfare of the state. Yours truly is happily chairman of that committee. The committees are all working very hard at their tasks, and presumably when the commission as a whole meets next month, November 20th, all the committees will have tentative recommendations to make, which will be discussed by the commission as a whole, and hopefully some kind of consensus will be generated out of that process. As you can see, the members of the committee of the commission are a mixed bag, and the process of generating consensus will not be easy. I think that's about all I can say, sir. Yes, sir.
Could you comment on the concern of some that there will now be a transfer of local control of many of the public programs to the state level with more centralization?
Yes, that's a very good point, and one that has concerned the members of the commission. Let me say on that point that it seems to me inevitable that financial responsibility, fiscal responsibility for many functions of government will have to be taken over by the state from the localities, simply because the state has the taxing resources to finance these functions. Talking, for instance, about welfare, talking about schools, I'm talking about health services, and parks and recreation, to take some examples. But let me make a distinction, if I may, that I think has been generally ignored in public discussion of this matter. Centralization of fiscal responsibility does not necessarily mean centralization of administrative responsibility. Let's take education. We have thousands of local school districts in California. They operate rather autonomously. Now, and they operate with some state aid. About 35% of their funds come from the state now. But let's say the state takes over 100%. Of the fiscal responsibility. Does this mean that the role of the local community in educational policy will be diminished, is the question. I say it does not necessarily mean that. And indeed, when you look at the very poor output of our schools in terms of educational product, one can very well ask himself whether we ought to perpetuate a system that has produced so sorry a result. Because there is an almost perfect inverse correlation between the amount of money annually spent per pupil year and the educational achievement of the students that graduate from these schools, which suggests that if we cut the amount of money, you know, and reverse the process, we might get better results. So I don't think that local control, as it's called, has produced such dazzlingly beneficial results that we should perpetuate the system. What I would argue for is, along with state financing, the state should set minimum standards of achievement. That is, we should expect from our schools a certain minimum output. And I think the best way of doing this is for the state to set a statewide examination for every grade in the school. And if the kids don't pass the exam, this is a reflection not only on the input of the student, but also the quality of the teaching and the competency with which the local school board has administered the program. And since the state controls the money, it can do something about the meeting of minimum standards. Now, this still leaves to the local school board the job of selecting the teachers, of building the facilities, selecting the school books, deciding how they will meet that minimum standard, and also whether they wish to offer additional courses or impose standards that are above the minimum. But I think it would be a very valuable step toward rehabilitating the American public school system, which God knows it needs it very badly. And it would, you know, and it would, I believe, involve the school boards even more than they are today in the educational process. So again, let me emphasize the vitality of the distinction between centralizing fiscal responsibility and maintaining local administration. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. If you could take a choice between a Proposition Type 13 tax limitation on the one hand, or a percentage of personal income for both state and local taxes on the other, which would you choose? Have I made the question?
Yes, there? Yes, I think so. The question is whether the people, the public, will benefit more from an overall limitation on spending than upon eliminating the amount of the revenue from a particular tax. Well, I think the former definitely is more logical, and I believe it will be such a limitation will be adopted in California. I think the commission is going to recommend such a limit. Yes, sir.
You talk about the systematic bias of the political process. I'm a little concerned about the legislative process, but I think it's more important. A few years ago, there was a proposal that we have every bill sponsored be accompanied by an addendum of where the funding would come from. Secondly, it had a proposal that could be sunset legislation in place of all proposed bills. I don't ever know what happened.
No, sir, I have no special information on that point. I do observe that Senator Muskie's bill in the U.S. Congress apparently is scheduled now for passage, which would terminate every federal spending program if inquiry and assessment does not succeed in justifying a surplus of social benefit over cost.
I can answer that.
I'm the author of one of those measures, and it is enacted into law. What it requires is that the legislative analysts will be given the authority by the Rules Committee to make such a determination on a piece of legislation. The reason it goes to the Rules Committee is because you introduce about 5,000 bills a session, and the amount of money that it would take to put hire additional people to do that type of analysis would be too expensive. Sunset legislation has been implemented in certain specific proposals which have been enacted by the legislature, but as far as a final concept, the fact that it's being included in all bills, that is not the case. However, you might understand that each year, each committee, within the Ways and Means Committee in the lower house and the Finance Committee in the upper house, does go in along with the legislative analyst to reevaluate each of the various agencies that we have. But the concept that you have, the philosophy behind it, is that you have a majority party who feels that the answer to success in our state is to have a larger bureaucracy versus those of us who feel that a smaller bureaucracy is the way to have fiscal achievement and individual liberty and let's say, you know, prosperity here. So that can only be changed at the electoral process, and that's the problem that we have.
I know that I proposed and an estimate that we would cut down the bill sponsorship by roughly about 80% by line breakers.
I think the best way of reducing that would be to reduce the number of days that the legislature meets.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that one of the major causes of spending public unbalanced collective bargaining for public employee sector. And this morning I just noticed in the paper that the judge in California ruled that the way promotion and pay increases were made under contract and constitutional, and this is a decision that was made by Governor Brown, so we need to suspend all pay increases. If there is no change in the law governing public employees in the state, don't you think that it's simply you might find yourself in a crappy situation where you're going to have to spend more money anyway, or should California adopt a civil service reform that would like to be done when it comes up to practice?
Well, I would remind you that the decision you referred to was with a lower court, and unquestionably will be appealed to higher courts. And what the Supreme Court ultimately will say is a matter of conjecture. I'm inclined to think that the Supreme Court may uphold the state's decision in this matter. And remember, too, that what the court held was that there was a contract between the city concerned, I've forgotten the name of it, and the public employees union, which could not be abrogated. On the other hand, I don't know of any law that compels the state to give money to the city, excepting under the conditions that the state specifies, so that we may end up with the city having an obligation without money to enforce it, which means they may have to impose new taxes on their own citizens that the citizens will reject. Now, what the public employees union would do under that condition is difficult to predict. There are many interesting scenarios that one could write. I should point out further that the Supreme Court of California has upheld Proposition 13 in every particular. That proposition did not, of course, cover the so-called bailout money distribution terms, but it did support the 2% annual increase on in assessed values that had many had attacked, and all of the other features of the law. Yes.
Democratic government, the fact that the advantage of a democratic government is that you can, as you read in California,
against it. Cannot do that either. The other thing, the question, what do you think of limiting the number, the proportion of the adult population that a government can employ governmental pursuits as a supplementary way of reducing the standards of the group?
Well, what you are suggesting, most limits on the size of government that have been proposed, to my knowledge, have been written in terms of limiting the proportion of governmental spending to the state product or the national product. You're now suggesting that one might limit the proportion of gainfully employed persons that government might employ in a state or in the nation. I really haven't thought through the implications of that. It's an interesting idea. The problem is, the question that immediately occurs to me is, would such a limit put necessary pressure on government to improve productivity? Maybe it would put additional pressure on. If it does have that effect, then I would say that's a very definite merit. Because productivity in the public sector, I think every economist who's looked at it will agree with me, is abysmally low. It's abysmally low, and whenever you find comparable tasks in the public sector and the private sector, public sector productivity is not just a little lower, it's about half or less that in the private sector. So we need to invent ways of stimulating higher productivity. Maybe the President's new civil service reform bill will help. I hope so, although I remain skeptical. I think your idea is a very interesting one, and I'd like to think explore it further. Yes, sir.
I understand that there are measures underway to retroactively increase the property tax assessment level on a local level, program control on a local level. To what extent do you think these measures will have an intended or consequential effect on the beneficial aspects of property? Measures such as this augur for the necessity of a direct limitation on government spending rather than the back door on the president.
Well, I've already mentioned in response to this gentleman's question in front that I think that an overall limit on governmental spending, probably written in terms of a declining percentage of state and local spending to the value of the state product, will be adopted in California. But coming directly to the other part of your question, to what extent is Proposition 13 being defeated or evaded by assessment practice? There's no question that many assessors, in an effort to try to minimize the reduction in property tax revenues, have readjusted assessed values as of 1975-76, which is the base year specified in Prop 13, which had been too low before. I haven't seen any evidence of that they have unfairly adjusted them, but we must remember that property is not assessed, all property, every year. For instance, in Los Angeles County, we have a system where under one-third of the property is reassessed, so that each year only one-third will be up to date and the other two-thirds are still lagging in an era of inflation. Now what the assessors have been doing is bring that other two-thirds up to the current 1976 level, and then applying the 2% annual increase factor to bring it up to 78. And that has produced some more revenue. But I don't think that should be considered as an effort to defeat Proposition 13, but simply as an effort to apply it systematically and to get as much revenue under it as it can. Yes, sir.
I understand the surplus in the next budget will only be about half of what you're wishing. 50% or something like that. I think you're going to be correct. But you can tell me what you expect the next surplus will be. If it is less than what it is this year, what money is being distributed to help, you know, pay the cost of the loss of revenue at the local level, what will happen if it is, depending on what that surplus is, what will happen in terms of the government trying to make up that loss of other taxes, or if you're trying to say,
well, my assessment is that unless we have a serious recession, and I don't see that in the next 12 months, the surplus available to assist the local governments in the next fiscal year will be just about as great as it was this last year. In fact, it may be too much, in the sense that it removes economizing pressure from the local governments. It's very important that that economizing pressure be kept on them, because without it, we will continue some of these outmoded spending programs, and we will not adopt the more efficient practices that that are needed in the long run to improve the productivity. But it now, I think Mr. Bell, the state finance director, has said that the surplus as of next fiscal year will be about $5 billion, which will permit the state to spend, again, something like $4 billion in bailout money, which is what it spent this last year. Yes, sir.
You say there's a lack of competition in public administration in that process. Lack of competition that causes or drives for it. Is there any way to prorate a public administrator's salary and just in document that that has been the cause of competition?
Well, what ideally what we should do in public sector, as we do in the private, is to reward efficiency, tight management, cost cutting. Actually, we do the very reverse, because we base salary increases in the public sector on the size of the budget supervised by the civil servant and the number of people who report to him. So what incentive has he got to cut, to do things more efficiently and get rid of superfluous personnel? He's paid for doing the very opposite, for becoming more inefficient. Now, the new civil service bill that President Carter has signed, I understand, I haven't looked at it in detail, helps to correct some of these faults by taking some of the senior civil servants out of the tenure category, subjecting them to removal if they perform badly, and giving them special incentive pay if they perform well. So maybe we're on the way to correcting this flaw. I hope so. But my point was, you see, that the market provides an automatic test of efficiency. The inefficient business executive finds that his profits are diminishing, his market share is falling, and the time comes when the board of directors said, let's get rid of this guy. He's not performing. The market provides an automatic test of his efficiency. But there's no counterpart in the public sector for that. Yes?
Doctor, what is the current increase in productivity?
Very poor. It's been very, very low recently. And that's something that's troubled many of us. We all have our theories about it. My own theory is that part of it's due to inflation. And inflation, one of the most pernicious effects of inflation is the destruction of morale. Now, this is a factor that economists don't usually take into account in their equations. You know, when you talk about lowering inflation, they say, well, this is going to mean higher unemployment, look at all the lost production. They never talk about the lost production from lower productivity, which results from the immorality of the whole inflationary process and the inequities that people feel and the loss of motivation and morale that they suffer from, which, of course, is reflected in low productivity. But it's been very low in the public sector as well recently. But again, I would ascribe a good deal of that to the results of inflation, and would hope that if and when we succeed in eliminating inflation as a conscious element in our decision making, that private productivity will rise again. But I think the cause of low productivity in the public sector is different. You see, we don't have an incentive and reward system there that produces productivity. I think this gentleman was.
What exactly is it that government produces in Detroit? We only look at Detroit as part. And so we can measure management from the production of parts, the efficient production of parts. And I'm just curious how we would apply that to whatever this is that government produces, first of all. And once we decide what it is that it produces, how does this economic system determine changes in that production? They seem to be political questions rather than economic ones.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your
question. Well, I mean,
your question.
Government produces everything from welfare to red tape. Now, at some point along the line, it seems to me that if we impose these efficiencies, that we can do one of two things with the welfare program. We can make it more efficient, which is to say we find more people to put on welfare. That is
No. They're very reversed. If we made it more efficient, we'd probably have less people on welfare because we eliminate the $7 billion of fraud that HEW itself admits to.
Well, if that's only if the bill, you see, around which this is going to be done is written in a way that it does precisely that. The argument seems that if you cut down on money, it will necessarily cut down the welfare program. And I don't see how that necessity is there. There may be some probability for it, but it seems that's a political question as opposed to an economic one. But simply cutting the money not going to make those who are demanding a slice of the pie go away. They will only demand a bigger share of perhaps a smaller pie.
Well, but having less money to spend may mean that the welfare administrators are going to take a harder look at some of the statements that come in from their clients. And they may check out a few more of them and find they're cheating and throw them off the rolls.
But that in no way addresses the problem of welfare. Any more than it does defense spending or anything like that. It only means that somehow these things have to
I don't understand it when you say it doesn't address the problem well. The problem of welfare administration is to provide need to the needy and to deny it to the greedy, isn't it? And we're not doing a very good job of that. The question is, how do you improve the administration of welfare? Your HEW makes an internal audit and by their own admission say, we got $7 billion of cheating. This is equal to the entire income tax collections of New England for a year. Being wasted. It's probably twice as much that they haven't discovered, which is 10% of their entire budget. Now, the problem is to get rid of it. It's not to deny aid to the people that are qualified. But to assure that those that don't qualify are not cheating the public, the taxpayers. And sometimes by reducing money, the money available, you put a little additional pressure on the administrators to do their job better.
Well, now what would happen if this welfare system became more efficient instead with a smaller pie, and there was competition? Spending for education and spending for welfare, how would that difference be resolved on an economic basis?
It's not. It's resolved on a political basis. it's up to our representatives to try to weigh the social benefits again and the social costs of more spending on education versus that more on welfare.
Now, what if it comes to the decision that one or the other or both need for some reason to be increased? That's a political decision that's rendered.
Yeah.
And yet the people are faced with a limitation either on taxation itself or on spending. And that limitation takes the form of Prop 13, for instance, where we need a tremendous number of the electorate to pass an override of some sort. It seems to me that somehow that direct link between the people and the things that they want done is interrupted, perhaps unnecessarily. I'm not sure of that.
Well, it seems to me that apart from being interrupted, it's reestablished. What happened in California, for instance, was that there was a breakdown of the legislative process. The representatives of the people that we all elected proved unable to come forth with a tax reform bill that commanded the support of the people. So fortunately, we have the initiative and referendum process in California, which is really, in a sense, a statement that we reject what the legislature's done. We're going to take this into our own hands. We will make a decision. We, the people, directly. Going back to the old Greek notion of democracy, where everybody met in the theater and they all voted. In other words, Prop 13 was a case of the replacement of representative democracy with direct democracy, where the legislative process, the representative process, had broken down.
Not to make a point here, but doesn't it, what is the circumstances for an override in the locality for an increase in taxation? Something like 2/3 of the total registered voters?
That's been interpreted to mean 2/3 of those who voted in an election. Yes.
Of those who voted in the election.
Who voted in the election, yes, sir.
And that seems to be a large number. In other words, it is in its way a check against the referendum and the initiative. That is, one can't override these.
You have to have a 2.
For bonds,
that's right, that's for bonds too, right?
It always has been, or has been for
that's correct, sir. Yes, Mr. Edelman.
Just on the point that you made before, on the necessarily good inefficiency of public service, I certainly agree with that point because the lack of public specialists. What do you think of advertising a number of services now performed? I can't see any greater protection to having garbage collected privately and private collected being paid rather than having it collected by public employees. And I think there are quite a number of presently functions presently defined as government functions that could easily be found out with private contractors and probably be performed.
Yes, indeed I do. But let me point out something that happened while we weren't looking in California, particularly in Los Angeles. The public employee union succeeded in getting approval at an election when the voters were apathetic, of a cute little provision in the city charter that prohibits the city council from awarding contracts for any governmental product or service to the private sector where there are public employees able to perform that service. Well, that practically deprives the city council of the opportunity of seeking a private bid against the public employee cost of any given thing. Now, that should be obviously thrown out of the charter. It has a similar governmental cost-raising, productivity-lowering effect as the so-called prevailing wage clause, which the city employees unions have also got written into the charter, but which is out now in the county, and I think it's coming up at the city at the next election. Impartial studies, which I could cite, indicate that the total compensation package of the California public employee, including here not just straight pay, but paid vacations, paid holidays, fat pension arrangements and so on, is about 20% higher than that of the private employee doing similar work. So that to put a moratorium on increases in public pay for a year really is helping to restore equity to the whole wage structure, which had been destroyed by this imbalanced collective bargaining process that we were talking about earlier. No, there are great opportunities for private performance of many services now done by public employees. And at least the opportunity should always be open, because this does put a little competitive pressure on the public sector, which God knows it needs. Yes, sir.
I think a case can be made to show that less than half of the public funds.
Frighteningly high. I think I saw some figures recently that in Los Angeles County, they run around 35%, 35-40% in that level. And if we could cut them to a nominal figure, we probably could do the needy more good at less cost to the taxpayer. And the negative income tax strikes me as being a very sane approach to that problem. Yes, sir.
One criticism that of Proposition 13 that concerned me was with the less revenue going to local tax and districts, necessity, supposedly, these districts would have to rely on the state for basic funding. You stated that there may be some justification for centralizing the accumulation of the capital to return or to pay off the districts, but that there's a dichotomy between that and administrative centralization. Now, I've talked with a few liberals or Democratic office holders, and they've stated to me, in effect, the glee with the tremendous new power that they've never, ever enjoyed over California in every detail in our 100-year history. My question is, what's the incentive for the legislature, for those members that sit on the commission with you, recognize the dichotomy between those two functions? In other words, what's the guarantee, if any at all, that we're not going to be looking at some kind of administrative centralization, the very same people that created the problem historically in the last 40 or 50 years?
Well, there's no guarantee, of course, that any particular formula will lead us to the promised land. But I think that the mistake has been to assume simplistically that the taking over of a financial burden necessarily implies an assumption of an administrative burden. And I think that when we recognize that there is a duality here, that there are two distinct things we're talking about, and if indeed the people want local control, as they put it, of their school, and a successful democracy, it seems to me, does require widespread public participation in administrative processes, that we can have our cake and eat it. We can have 100% state financing, with the state setting, as I suggest, minimum standards of achievement, and letting the local school boards decide how to meet those minimum, giving them every power to adopt programs, but their laws be tested with reference to their achievement of the minimum. After all, you know, the educational function is a function of the state. The state is sovereign in our system. The state has the right and the power, and I think the responsibility to establish minimum standards, whether it puts the money up or not. Putting up the money is incidental, don't you think? Or it should be. Yes, sir?
Back to your welfare statements, it seems to me there's a basic inconsistency in your position. You mentioned that you want to increase for prevention of fraud and waste and mismanagement and welfare system requires the proper direction of the use of your employees and resources in the system and establishing the product you want to achieve. On the other hand, you're talking about the high administrative cost in welfare, which includes both the things that you said we want to do, such as preventing fraud and wasteful use of persons in the welfare system. So then you're saying, let's throw out all those administrative costs and go to a simplified eligibility of a negative income tax. It seems to me what you should be saying is, let's make a distinction between wasteful uses of people resources and valid uses and start to make a distinction, and rather than this all or nothing approach, as I think.
Well, I didn't intend to imply that you'd reduce administrative costs to nothing by going to a negative income tax. Obviously, it would mean an extension of the income tax return form to lower income groups. But we do have in the IRS a mechanism now, an administrative mechanism, that could be utilized, it seems to me, to a much larger extent than it is, in administering negative as well as positive tax program. And that we could achieve any given level of administrative efficiency at lower cost under a negative income tax formula than we can under the present case analysis system. I see you shaking your head.
Yes, I personally believe that welfare system, if you run it like a business, you use people to accomplish certain things. And if you eliminate the people and you go to the federal level and you have forms, you're not going to detect fraud, you're not going to increase child support, you're not going to get persons into jobs. And if you go away from the local government levels, you end up with a system that's not going to accomplish the basic goals that you seek to accomplish.
Well, we have a difference of opinion. I don't pretend to be a specialist in that area, public administration by any means. But I am appalled at the high cost of administering our present welfare system. Don't they frighten you a little bit?
Yes.
Okay, I think this lady in the rear had a question. Yes. Well, of course, if it worked out that way practically, merely superimposing another program on the already excessive number of welfare programs, one would have to oppose it. One thing that we've discovered is that it's always easier to add than it is to subtract, to liquidate, and the obsolete in government. And indeed, I found this true as an academic in the universities. Anybody who wants to abolish something is faced with a hard uphill fight, but it's very easy to add. The sunset law, I suppose, is an invention that hopefully may help us resolve that problem. It remains to be seen. Yes.
At least on the federal level, indirect spending, form of federal subsidy and loan guarantee grant has become a larger problem, perhaps even to a certain extent overshadows the problems addressed by direct spending. Do you believe that spending limitations on the state or federal level should be directed at the issue of indirect spending by the state or federal level?
You mean what you're talking about really are the grant programs? Extra budgetary, yes. Well, we know that Congress has multiplied these extra budgetary liabilities. Sometimes they take the form of spending, sometimes soft loans, which will have to be written off as much of our educational loans are going to have to be. Sometimes they take the form of loan guarantees and so on. We did try to bring all this within the budget, but it's a constant battle to keep it there. Because putting them outside the budget always makes the deficit appear less than it really is. And I guess we simply may have to have another budgetary reform bill to try to corral all the other new programs that would come in outside the budget back into it again. In other words, should soft loans be included in spending in your definition? Well, you raised a very interesting and important question. I don't pretend to have thought it through, but I would certainly be in favor of a definition that was as comprehensive as needed to circumvent that avenue of escape. I may say that one thing that the subject that our commission is looking into with some care is the effect of these federal grant programs on the level of state and local spending. And one hypothesis that we have formulated is that they have served to increase state and local spending well beyond the levels that the public would approve if they had a chance to vote on them. In a sense, they use processes of political seduction. You know, we start a new federal spending program, and Uncle Sam puts up 80 cents, and the city puts up 20 cents to start. Well, it's pretty hard to resist that. You know, you're going to hire a lot of new people, and you can make some political friends, and some of the local pals go along with the thing. And then later, the federal government cuts its share to 60%. And still later to 40, and then 20, and finally they leave the locality with the program dangling. And what we have is a lot of money spent in ways that are of dubious value and would probably be opposed by a popular plebiscite. I think there's a great deal of water in the 450 categorical aid programs that the federal government is financing in the half dozen block grant programs, and even in the general revenue sharing, although that may be the most innocent form. The amount of water in the federal budget is unquestionably enormous. Well, it looks as if we've just about exhausted the subject.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Jacoby. Break, and then we'll resume with Dr. Woodson.
One announcement.
Anybody who hasn't registered, please register.
Thanks for switching over.